Hey everyone. Welcome back and thank you for being here. I don't think this will be a super long episode, but it might be really complicated. And it should be the only episode we need for this series. I am drinking some blueberry hibiscus tea that my friend gave me in a cup that is beautiful, which she also gave me. Anyway, just wanted to throw that out there because, it's the spice of life. It's what makes things nice. And in fact, our series today is on Deleuze, specifically Deleuze's essay called Immanence, a Life. So, spice of life, what makes life worth living? A life for Deleuze is in the indefinite. Let me start screen sharing some stuff. It's the indefinite article, which also means that it's asubjective or apersonal. A life is not just my life, but it's our life, and presumably maybe something beyond what we can say is our, if I no longer exist. Right, maybe like 3 generations down, that's not our, none of us will exist for that life, but life will continue. Or another reality, another dimension, another way of configuring the laws of nature. Deleuze's argument is that life still comes behind that. That's still a life. But in order to help us understand, so that's in this text, this book. It's also in Two Regimes of Madness, but it's not the essay that I've got excerpted from Two Regimes of Madness. Two Regimes of Madness is, and Deleuze's first name is Giez, Gilles, but you pronounce it Giez. He's a French philosopher. Not as well known as Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, but I think he's a little bit crazier or more fun. Maybe not necessarily. In this essay, Immanence of Life, he cites Jean-Paul Sartre's Transcendence of the Ego. So he's coming off of his tales. Deleuze was also heavily influenced by Bergson, Spinoza, and in our series on affect earlier with Brian Mitsumi's coming out of Deleuze too. Deleuze passed away in 1995. He was born, I think he was in his 60s or his 70s. I'm not sure when he was born. I don't think my books have it in there. Giez Deleuze, born in 1925, so he died at 70. Reading some of his lectures, like his seminars, the way he interacts with his students is just really sweet and wholesome. Or like, not, I mean, sweet isn't the right word, but wholesome is the right word. Like I read this one, I haven't read too many of his seminars, but one of them he says, let me pull it up. He basically says, don't give up on your reading. Or he asks them, and he's like, okay. And he's like, they're like, no, we haven't given up. And he's like, okay, good. I really want you to keep trying. On that note, I have a lot left of him to read. This one? Yeah. We'll just read a few lines from it. And I think this is the one that I wanted to read No. So this is the one on the University of Bean. I need to check what I plan to do with that. Trying to remember because let me pause for just a second. We may cover. I mean, even if we don't do it in full, we need to mention it here because he's going to mention university and so the important paragraphs. Okay, so just to recap, we want to read Eminence of Life, which is about transcendence versus immanence as w structural ways of conceiving the metaphysics or ontology of reality or consciousness. It has implications for logic, religion, politics, ethics, cognitive science, consciousness studies, plenty more things. But I think it'll be helpful for us to start with another shorter text that's kind of slanted called Zones of Immanence, where he contrasts it more directly against the transcendent tradition or the tradition of transcendence. But in Immanence of Life, he doesn't. I used to think that he was replacing transcendence with immanence, and he kind of is. He is truly inverting the primacy of immanence. But it's so difficult to think of what that means because you and I are transcendent, T. So this word right here, TRANCESCENDENT, transcendence, not NCE, NTS, that kind of ence, transcendence, like plural transcendent. And a transcendent is the particular that comes about as a result of the actualization of the plane of immanence into a particular form, as determined by immanence itself. But when it is actualized in a subject and an object, it instantiates the transcendental field and consciousness. So we'll come back to this later when it should hopefully make more sense. But Deleuze says in Immanence of Life, the relation of the transcendental field to consciousness is only a conceptual one. Consciousness becomes a fact only when a subject is produced at the same time as its object, both being outside the field and appearing as transcendence. And so, okay, we can just start at the top. And so, in order to like kind of start parsing immanence, I thought we could look at zones of immanence again. And this has some reference to translation and phenomena and experience. We'll read it all, but some important points that stand out to me are the two movements in immanence, complication and explication. So he says that the one complicates the many, while the many explicates the one. And what he says is that God complicates each thing, while each thing explicates God. The multiple is in the one which complicates it, just as the one is in the multiple which explicates it. Theory will never finish reconciling these two aspects or these two universes. In one way, this is probably similar to what Sartre saw as the kind of divergent tendencies between philosophy, or sorry, psychology and phenomenology. But before that, before we even get to there, down there, he says that being is univocal, and that's kind of hard to understand too. So I thought we could look at equal. In other words, every entity is equally being in the sense that each actualizes its power in immediate vicinity with the first cause. So I thought we could look at a seminar on the different notions of being in the Middle Ages. Just a few pages at least, and then we'll switch over to the other texts. So this is the seminar on Anti-Oedipus 3, the third series, I think, from 1973 to 1974. And this is the second lecture on January 14th, 1974. It's from webdeleuze.com, translated by Timothy S. Murphy. Roughly called the University of Being. And so this is Deleuze's seminar. I must pass through a kind of terminological detour. This detour consists in recalling a certain terminology. Sorry, I just had to make sure it looked right. This detour consists in recalling a certain terminology. We find that in the whole current of the Middle Ages, up to and including the 17th century, a certain problem is posed concerning the nature of being. And this problem concerning the nature of being adopted some very precise notions: equivocity, analogy, univocity. And so he's going to explain what those are. Univocity is that each thing is the same. Equivocity is that each thing is completely different, and analogy is some way of kind of reconciling those two. At first sight, these terms appear dead to us. They make it part of the great discussions of scholasticism, but the great metaphysical disputes always hide something else. People are never burned or tortured over ideological questions, even less over metaphysical ones. I would like for us to try to feel what was very concretely in question in these stories, which were presented under an abstract form. Is being equivocal? Is it analogical? Is it univocal? And after all, this is not because today, except among the seminarians, we have abandoned these terms, not because we do not continue to think in them and through them. That probably is supposed to say, after all, this is because today, or this is not the case, or we have a hard time understanding it, because we don't know the words, not because we don't know the ideas. I would like to continue to content myself with very simple definitions. There are people who said being is equivocal. They argued, they burned one another for things like that. But being is equivocal meant a precise thing. Being is said in several senses. That means being is said in several senses of that of which it is said. That is to say that the implication of the proposition was already being is said of something. I'm not even interested in knowing if it's an ontological problem. It's a problem of utterances as well. Being is stated in several senses of that of which it is stated. Concretely, what does that mean? One assumes that a table is not in the same manner as an animal, and that an animal is not in the same manner as a man, that a man is not in the same manner as God. Therefore, there are several senses of being. So it's just like communicating in the first place. Those who were called the partisans of equivocity, no matter who they were, argued a very simple thing, that the different senses of the word being were without common measure, and that in all rigor, so this is that they're exactly different. And what is interesting in theology are always the limit points at which heresy peaks out. In every doctrine, one can always locate the exact point where, if the person says a word more, that's it. The machine is set in motion. One starts a process. That runs through the whole history of the Middle Ages. It's very interesting because it's an actual struggle of an obviously political nature. Well, then the heretical point of equivocity is that those who said that being is said in several senses, and that these different senses have no common measure, understood that at the limit they would have preferred to say God is not, rather than to say he is, to the extent that he is was an utterance which was said at the table or the chair, or else he is in such an equivocal manner, such a different manner, without common measure with the being of the chair, with the being of man, etc., that all things considered, it's much better to say he is not, which means he is superior to being. But if they had a sense of wordplay, this became very dangerous. It sufficed that they insist only a little on God is not. If they were discreet, they said, God is superior to being. But if they said, God is not, that could turn out badly. Broadly speaking, they were partisans of what is called the equivocity of being. Then there were those who were partisans of the univocity of being. They risked even more, because what does this mean? Univocity in opposition to the equivocity of being. And all the treatises of the Middle Ages are filled with long chapters on the univocity or equivocity of being. It's very interesting. But those who said that being is univocal, supposing that they had done so and were not immediately burned, what did that mean? That meant being has only one sense and is said in one and the same sense of everything of which it is said. Here one feels that if the equivocists already had such a possible sin in themselves, the univocists were thinkers who told us, of everything which is, being is said in one and the same sense, of a chair, of an animal, of a man, or of God. Yet again, I'm simplifying everything because perhaps they didn't dare go that far. Perhaps there's only a single thinker who would have gone that far, perhaps none. But in the end, there is this idea. And then inevitably, there are those who are between the two, between the univocists and the equivocists. Those who are between the two are always those who establish what we call orthodoxy. Says the most interesting thing sometimes. These people said that being is not univocal because it's a scandal. To claim that being is said in one and the same sense of God and of the flea is a terrible thing. We must burn people like that. And then those who say being is said in several senses which have no common measure, we no longer know where we are with them. There is no order anymore. There's no longer anything. Thus, these third people said, being is neither equivocal nor univocal. It's analogical. Here we can say the name, the one who elaborated theory of analogy on the basis of Aristotle, St. Thomas, and historically he won. Being which is analogical meant, yes, being is said in several senses of that of which it is said, only these senses are not without common measure. These senses are governed by relations of analogy. Thus, the equivocity of being, the univocity of being, the analogy of being, you're going to ask me where all this leads us. He gives an explanation of analogy and then critiques it. And I'm not sure we need to cover all that. Here, let's just jump in here. At this point, I make a leap. Well, let's see if we need to get this in. At this point, I make a leap. What appears to me the strangest thought, the most difficult to think, if it has ever been thought, is univocity. Suppose someone arrives here in an assembly of priests, or even here, and says, being is said, or arrives there in an assembly of priests, or even here, and says, being is said absolutely in one and the same sense of everything of which it is said. One could say that this does not go very far, but this means precisely that being is univocal. That is to say, neither analogical nor equivocal, and understanding very well that in the Middle Ages those sorts were very up to date on all of this, as you are. If someone happened by speaking of univocity of being, he was quickly spotted. He could pack his bags. That meant yet again that a chair, an animal, a man, and God are in one and the same sense. Then what? You treat God as matter? Are a dog and a man in the same sense? Quite tricky that. But it's in Zones of Immanence, he's saying that immanence is the place of univocity, that within Zones of Immanence, being is e univocal, equal. And nevertheless, back to the seminar. And nevertheless, there is a man, the greatest thinker of the Middle Ages, who says, yes, being is univocal. That is Duns Scotus. This story of Duns Scotus's univocal being turns out rather badly, but happily he took precautions. He said, yes, but be careful. Being is univocal insofar as it is being. That is to say that it's metaphysically univocal. He said, sure, it's analogical, which is to say that it's said in several senses physically. This is what interests me. He was at the border of heresy had he not specified metaphysically univocal and physically analogical. He would have been done for. We might be able to draw a comparison between the one substance in Spinoza and the infinity of the infinity slash multiplicity of modes or pathways or actions, also Spinoza. And Deleuze is influenced by this. Spinoza was influenced by Duns Scotus, from what a friend told me. I'm pretty sure that's right. I mean, like, that's right. But for Duns Scotus's disciples, less prudent than he was, it turned out badly. Because I say being is univocal, this means there is no categorical difference between the assumed senses of the word being, and being is said in one and the same sense of everything which is. In a certain manner, this means the tick is God. There is no difference of category. There is no difference of substance. There is no difference of form. It becomes a mad thought. My question is, if I say being is univocal, it's said in the same sense of everything of which it's said, then what could the differences between beings be? They can no longer be differences of category. They can no longer be differences of form. They can no longer be differences of genus and species. And why can they no longer be all that? Because once again, if I say the differences between beings are differences of form, are formal, generic, specific differences, at that moment I cannot escape from the analogy of being for this simple reason. The categories are the ultimate genera of being. If I say there are several senses of the word being, which are precisely the categories, I must say that what is, that of which I say this is distinguished by the form, the species, the genus. On the other hand, if I say that being is univocal and that it's said in one and the same sense of everything of which it's said, I fall into that which becomes the mad thought, the thought of infamy, the thought of the formless, the thought of the non-specific, the thought of the non-generic. The only means of getting out of this is to say, of course there are differences between beings, And in any case, being is said in one and the same sense of everything which is, then what do the differences between beings consist in? The only difference conceivable at this very moment from the point of view of a univocal being is obviously differences solely as degrees of power. Puissance. Beings are not distinguished by their form, their genus, their species. That's secondary. Everything which is refers to a degree of power. Why is the idea of degrees of power fundamentally linked to that of the univocity of being? Because beings which are diminished, or which are distinguished solely by the degree of their power, are beings which realize a single, univocal being, except for the difference in the degree of power or its withdrawal. So, like, an assemblage, assemblage is the word that he uses, Deleuze uses, but it's a way of thinking of the affective network that a person commands. And because Spinoza bundles the individual with their causation systems, both the causes that flow through them, so that my personhood is not strictly within my control, even unless I assimilate the influences that have come across me, and the things I affect in the world are my responsibility and are part of me, in the sense of an assemblage of power. So, between a table, a little boy, a little girl, a locomotive, a cow, a god, the difference is solely one of degree of power and the realization of one and the same being. It's a strange way of thinking, since once again it consists in saying to us the forms, the functions, the species, and the genera are second. Beings are defined by degrees of power, and there you are. Insofar as they are defined by degrees of power, each being realizes one and the same being as the other being, since being is said in one and the same sense, except for the difference in degree of power. At this level, there are no longer any categories, no longer any forms, no longer any species. So this is just a small, in a sense, it's a thought so very far from the ordinary notions of species and genus that, once again, between two members of the same species, the animal species here, there can be more differences in the degree of power than between two beings of different species. Between a racehorse and a draft horse, which belong to the same species, the difference can perhaps be thought as greater than the difference between a draft horse and an ox, which comes down to saying that the draft horse and the ox are taken in the same assemblage, and that their degrees of power are closer to one another's than is the draft horse's degree of power to the racehorse's. I skip down again to page six, top of page six. Let's try to imagine how Spinoza saw things. He did not see genera, species. He did not see categories. So what did he see? He saw differences of degrees of power. I said broadly that to each thing will correspond a kind of degree of power, and that if need be, two things said to be of the same species might have degrees of power much more different than two things of different species. To make this more concrete, we say that to each degree of power corresponds a certain power of being affected. Its power of being affected is what reveals the degree of power of a thing, of an animal, of, and that word is actually just unclear in the audio recording, so they couldn't transcribe it. In other words, you will not be defined by your form, by your organs, by your organism, by your genus, or by your species. Tell me the affections of which you are capable, and I'll tell you who you are. Of what affects are you capable? It's self-evident that between a draft horse and a racehorse, the power of being affected is not the same in a fundamental way. The proof is that if you put a racehorse into the assemblage of a draft horse, it's quite likely that it will be worn out in 3 days. I think this is the last paragraph we'll need. We have this group of notions. Being is said in one and the same sense of everything of which it's said. Hence, beings are not distinguished by their form, their genus, their species. They're distinguished by degrees of power. These degrees of power refer to powers of being affected, the affects being precisely the intensities of which a being is capable. Now it's becoming more coherent. With the result that I assume, when Spinoza directed his eyes toward whatever, he grasped powers of being affected. He grasped populations of intensities. He grasped capacities. And perhaps he confused an ox and a draft horse. And on the other hand, he did not confuse a racehorse and a draft horse. As we would say today, he makes these cuts differently than the others. Then there's no more than an effort to accomplish. Okay, I think we're kind of like in the discourse to better understand what he's going to say with zones of immanence. This is certainly not a beginning of the semester text. I know it's intro 1301, but like if you've not been following along all semester in the kindest way possible, if it doesn't make sense to you, I mean, it's taken me a long time to make sense of this text, of the immanence of life. So I can understand if it takes a while, if it's still confusing. Sorry for being grumpy. Give me a second. Sorry about that. My eye was itching me pretty bad. Couldn't see. Okay, let's jump into zones of immanence. The original guiding question for the immanence of life text, was just what is a life? But that's, I mean, that's, that is the question of the text, certainly. And you could try to figure that out yourself, or I could give you five, seven more questions. And so I did that. I don't have answers to all these, but I at least wanted to read them to you before we read the text, because the texts are so short, guys. I don't know if I've said that yet. Zones of Immanence is 3.5 pages, and Immanence of Life is like 8. So I'm going to explain it and then just read them, and that's it. And it's like, it's not much time. I hope you guys like reading them. They're really cool ideas. Basically says that like consciousness is spread out everywhere. Anyway, which historical church? So these are my guiding questions. I wrote these for to help us process these texts. And this is just for zones of immanence, the first one. Which historical tradition contrasts with immanence? In other words, what foil does Deleuze start the essay with to help compare against and define immanence? And then, what are the two movements of immanence? So let's just read this first paragraph. A whole Platonic, and again, Zones of Immanence is in a collection called Two Regimes of Madness, Texts and Interviews, 1975 to 1995. Deleuze himself intended this and the Desert Islands, I think Desert Islands is 1955 to 1975. They're meant to be his last two books published in his life right before he passed away. I don't know if I've said it yet in this episode. I said in the last one, he did take his own life. He was very sick at 70. And after he put his affairs in order and processed as much philosophy, I think, as he could and done his things, he was in too much pain. So the reason I mentioned that is because Immanence of Life was the last essay that he wrote. In a way, it says everything about his philosophy, and in a way, it says everything about philosophy in general. It's a beautiful short text. It's a good one to end the semester on. Jean-Luc Nancy's Being Singular Plural is also really lovely and similar. And in some course designs, I have that assigned also. I'm not sure if I'll keep it forever. But yeah, let's do Zones of Eminence from the collected essays. And yeah, he put those two books together himself. So this other text, this other book, Pure Eminence, Essays on a Life, he did not put together. But he did put this one together, and Two Regimes of Madness with it. It's like all of his notes or his like smaller essays from, and some of them are strange and experimental. There's a lot of political stuff in here too. He has commentary on other philosophers. He has commentary on a lot of art and literature, and like I said, Eminence, A Life is in this one, and that's where he intended to publish it, but it just stuck out so much that they made it its own thing. I'm sure there's a lot more that could be said about it. I'm not like a historian on Deleuze, and I don't know him perfectly yet, although I think I do understand some of his key ideas. Okay. A whole Platonic, Neoplatonic, and medieval tradition is behind the idea of the universe as a great chain of being, as we have often been told. It is a universe suspended from the one as transcendent principle, unfolding in a series of emanations and hierarchical conversions. Entities have more or less being, more or less reality, according to their distance from or proximity to the transcendent principle. At the same time, however, a whole other inspiration traverses this cosmos. So that was the transcendental tradition, and now we're going to look at the immanent tradition. Zones of immanence seemingly proliferate at the various stages or levels, even establishing connections between levels. In these zones, being is univocal, equal. In other words, every entity is equally being, in the sense that each actualizes its power in immediate vicinity with the first cause. The distant cause is no more. Rocks, flowers, animals, and humans equally celebrate the glory of God in a kind of sovereign anarchy. The emanations and conversions of the successive levels are replaced by the coexistence of two movements in immanence, complication and explication, where God complicates each thing while each thing explicates God. The multiple is in the one which complicates it, just as the one is in the multiple which explicates it. All right. What other questions do we have for this text? So, what are the two movements of immanence? How do they relate to the classic problem of the one and the many? How might the one and the many relate to the simultaneity we saw in Sartre between first person freedom slash magic and third person determinism slash mechanism? And how might the simultaneity result in identity and difference? Do they determine their meanings in relation to each to one another? Like they being identity and difference, or the two movements, or the one in the many, the one in the multiple. Okay, think about that. If you have good answers for it, go for it. Tell me them. I'm interested. I have no idea. I mean, I think they do. I think they relate. But then to say how is more about doing phenomenology and articulating specific experiences and almost cataloging them, which isn't really what you need to do anyway. But an exemplary description of the phenomena is usually a good how. Three, how do horizontality and verticality relate to immanence and transcendence? He's going to use these terms, so just watch out for them. What two ideas form the basis of an expressionist philosophy, according to Deleuze? All right, and the rest of those are towards the end of the essay. To be sure, theory will never, this is back in Zones of Immanence. To be sure, theory will never finish reconciling these two aspects or these two universes, and most importantly, subordinating immanence to transcendence and measuring the being of immanence by the unity of transcendence. So he's critical of that. He's saying that's a mistake. theory does that, and it shouldn't. Whatever the theoretical compromises, something in the proliferations of eminence tends to overtake the vertical world, to reverse it, as if the hierarchy bred a particular anarchy and the love of God, an internal atheism proper to it. Heresy is flirted with every time, and the Renaissance will tirelessly develop and extend this immanent world, which can be reconciled with transcendence only at the cost of threatening to inundate it anew. This seems to me the most important aspect of Maurice de Gondillac's historical research, this play of immanence and transcendence, the proliferations of the earth into the celestial hierarchies. He was responsible for bringing these themes the attention they deserve. What a shame that his greatest book, La Philosophie de Nicolas de Cusa, is now so hard to find, not having been reprinted. In its pages, we watch a group of concepts being born, both logical and ontological, that will characterize modern philosophy through Leibniz and the German Romantics. One such concept is the notion of possessed, which expresses the immanent identity of act and power. And this flirtation with immanence, this competition between immanence and transcendence, already traverses the work of Eckhart, as well as the work of the Rhine mystics, and in another way, Petrarch's work too. I don't know any of those people, but that's okay. Moreover, Gondillac stresses that the seeds and the mirrors of immanence are already present in the early stages of Neoplatonism. Sorry, guys, give me one second. All right, sorry about that. Moreover, Gondillac stresses that the seeds and the mirrors of immanence are already present in the early stages of Neoplatonism. In his book on Plotinus, one of the finest of this philosopher, Gondillac shows how being proceeds from the one and yet nonetheless complicates each entity in itself, at the same time that it is explicated in each. Immanence of the image in the mirror, immanence of the tree in the seed. These two ideas are the basis for an expressionist philosophy. Even in the pseudo-Denis, the rigor of the hierarchies reserves a virtual place for zones of equality, univocity, and anarchy. Don't confuse equality with equivocity. The equa is not equal. Well, I mean, it is, but it means a different thing. And in fact, equi might be different from equa. Like equivalent versus, but the equal is the same too. That's just the traditions are different. You would hear equivocity and almost think, because equivocation, this is the funny thing that makes it so confusing. The issue with univocity, and we can understand that now because we read the other passage. This we can understand this sentence. But the issue that Deleuze presents about univocity in his seminar, that you can't conflate God with the rat or with a flea, you can't say them in the same way. That's called equivocation. Whenever you equivocate something is to conflate it or to blur the distinctions between it to say A is equal to B when it's really not. And so it's just a little confusing that univocity has equality while equivocity has radical difference, incommunicable difference. Anyway. Philosophical concepts are also modes of life and modes of activity for the one who invents them, or knows how to tease them out, giving them consistency. The mode of life emblematic of Maurice de Gondillac is precisely this ability to recognize the world of hierarchies at the same time that he conveys a sense of the zones of immanence within these hierarchies, which destabilizes them more effectively than a frontal attack. There is a kind of Renaissance man in Gondillac. His lively sense of humor is apparent in his fabric of immanence, complicating the most diverse things and persons in the self-same tapestry, at the same time that each thing, each person, explicates the whole. So this explicating the whole, you can tie that back with the elements in Bergson's Introduction to Metaphysics. Deleuze will know that and will be translating this elemental thing. And really, that's the issue with parts, is parts are supposed to be separate entities where there's some kind of transcendence over and across them. So X equals X, you start with some kind of identity, and then you have to, because you have an identity that is separate from a different identity, their communicability or the equi like their this is equivocal things, right? The transcendent world is the equivocal world. The analogical world is the one where there is some relation of communicability, or there's some mixture or simultaneity happening. In a way, Immanence of Life ends up constructing a sort of, it's almost an analogy of being between transcendence and immanence. But Deleuze does clearly put immanence first. And I prefer to think that his view of immanence is such that the one substance, or the one thing, or the one process, or the univocity is differentiation. Not difference, but differentiation, a process of relationality, or mitzain, or being with, or edge, in the work of Ed Casey. And I mentioned this in my interview with him. I was trying to tease out this idea in that interview. But I'm convinced that this sort of intentionality structure, perceptual, relational clinamen is also what Deleuze calls it. So the clinamen is an idea in, let's look at it. I guess there's a new art exhibit since the last time I taught this, but this is typically like how the Epicureans thought of the clinamen, that everything was going in a straight line. It was in this equivocal system, and there had to be some kind of swerve to make the transcendence or the communication between the analogy possible. Otherwise, there would never be really any kind of experience whatsoever. It would just all be in itselfness with no emanation. But Deleuze's way of translating the clinamen is to say that it's an original swerve, that the first thing is not the straight lines, the first thing is the swerving. The first thing, and Jean-Luc Nancy, in Listening, I think we can also tie in Listening here, because Nancy says that listening is musical when it is music that listens to itself. It returns to itself, it resonates with itself. So Nancy is all, and I mean, literally being singular plural is an emphatic approval of mitzain over and above dasein. Mitzain is the originary, it's the univocity. So we can use all these concepts to round each other out. And help us flesh out this conception of immanence and a relational process ontology, the mad thought of the univocity of differentiation and intensities of power. In networks of causation and horizontal exigences. I mean, there's certainly hermeneutical, affective, horizons, and histories and causations and flows still happening that we can't always bring to thetic perception before we can redirect them. Okay, so that's the clinamen. Let's look at a few more questions. So, what two ideas form the basis of an expressionist philosophy, according to Deleuze? We covered that. The idea of the immanence in the seed, or the image in the mirror, and the tree in the seed. And with the image in the mirror, it seems to be a sort of spatialization. I mean, even like right now, I'm looking at myself in the Zoom camera. It's not really a mirror because there's a capture and a representation. And I don't even know if it's, I think it is the exact same thing that's being captured. I don't know. I don't know if it stages it in a way that is different from what it processes, because then it converts the meaning later. Anyway, if I go grab a mirror, right? Like it's, I'm in the mirror and I'm here, and it's like I'm distanced from myself. The tree and the seed, however, is something that happens decades later. So it's the virtuality of the time to come. The mirror holds the virtuality of a flat depth. So maybe just, yeah, space and time is how I might try to put those. And then other questions. How does translation demonstrate the simultaneity between the one and the many, between God and the multiplicity of the world? And how does Deleuze's reconception of translation through Gondiac offer a notion of the world as linguistic, forming the basis of hermeneutical materialism? So this is also why it's brilliant. He has a great way of bringing, it's such a small little note, but all of the affective necessities and interpretive processes that go on both internally and externally, like where's my attention drawn? Okay, it's drawn to there for this reason because that's what I noticed from the history that I've had. When I see it, maybe you and I see different things in our environment, okay? Because we have different attentions, and our attentions are determined to some extent by what we're interested in. What we're interested in is determined by our history and the experiences we've had, failures and successes, pains and joys, or other reasons, but there are generally reasons. And so not only does it determine what we perceive, but how we perceive what we think is there? It's always interpretive. It's always the Sapir-Whorf thesis is an idea, is a thesis in sociology that says that every perception, like physical perception, every conscious experience is always filtered through the dimension of language. And cultures with different languages will have different perceptions of the same experience. Hermeneutical materialism. But at the level, at a more fundamental affective perceptual level, and in a way that doesn't necessarily need to make distinctions between language, meaning, communication, perception, affect, history, and intention, action, etc. And then I explained that hermeneutical materialism is the idea that sense communicates us to us through originary shared material communion. I think hermeneutical materialism is Benjamin's word, Benjamin's phrase. So it seems like this article by Benjamin Lovelock from 2011 in Philosophy and Social Criticism, that the abstract says this author argues that Benjamin explicitly rejected the Heideggerian alternative and chose a path closer to Gadamer. He attempted to combine theological interpretation with dialectical materialism, always grounding hermeneutics in the concrete manifestations of social life, inaugurating a method which I suggest could be called hermeneutical materialism. A politically motivated defense of the mimetic faculty understood as reinterpretation in the modern technologically organized world. Yeah, and I guess you could say that the mimetic faculty as reinterpretation is what Deleuze is going to say in the next paragraph. Let's just go to it. I'll jump ahead and go to it. But he's going to say that the original thought of an author, like a translator, must somehow include both the source text and the target text, at the same time that the target text explains in its own way the source text, though without any additional commentary. So when you make a translation, you have to have two equivalent phrases and some kind of idea bridging them. The source and the target. Any kind of translation or perception has to go through source and target. We don't always know that they're there. But at the most basic level, it's past and future, or old stock of beliefs and new data. The transformation from of the world from instant to instant, right? The refreshing of the intuition. By golly, like cooking dinner, the source text being the ingredients for the recipe and the target text being the finished product, and it requiring a lot of other sources other than just ingredients, like activity and methods and human capital, like knowing specifically, like knowing how to cook the recipe. Anyway, there's a broad way you can understand this sort of translation in a sort of in a hermeneutical materialist. Three-dimensional sense, four-dimensional sense. Sophia, come here. Come on. Being so slow, come on. Come here. Oh. Guys, look how big she is. I don't think I've ever shown you how big she is. She's huge. So I just want to repeat this and get us back into the pair. I know I read all of this already, but I want to repeat it again. Philosophical concepts are also modes of life and modes of activity for the one who invents them or knows how to tease them out, giving them consistency. The mode of life emblematic of Maurice de Gondillac is precisely this ability to recognize the world of hierarchies at the same time that he conveys a sense of the zones of immanence within these hierarchies, which destabilizes them more effectively than a frontal attack. There is a kind of Renaissance man in Gondillac. His lively sense of humor is apparent in his fabric of immanence, complicating the most diverse things and persons in the self-same tapestry at the same time that each thing, each person, explicates the whole. Tolstoy once said that the secret of feeling joyful was to ensnare, as in a spider web, however you could, since there is no rule. Quote an old man, sorry, quote an old woman, a child, a woman, and a police officer. An art of living and thinking is what Gondillac has always practiced and what he has reinvented. This is embodied in his concrete sense of friendship. We find it also in another one of Gondillac's activities. He's a skillful debater. He and Genevieve de Gondillac have breathed new life into the conferences at Cerisy. In one conference after another, which Gondillac organizes like successive terraces, he has inspired the kind of debate which points out zones of immanence, like the various parts of the self-same tapestry. The explicit contributions of Gondillac are brief and to the point, but they display a remarkable wealth of content. to such an extent that they should be gathered together in a volume. This wealth of content is often due to the philological nature of his remarks. And here we touch on another aspect of Gondiac's activity. If he is steeped in philology, philology is the study of words and the way that the word developed, kind of like linguistics. But linguistics looks more at, I think, some of the deep structures and other stuff, whereas philology is just, it was started by Nietzsche. If he is steeped in philology, being a Germanic scholar and translator, it is because the original thought of an author must somehow include both the source text and the target text, at the same time that the target text explains in its own way the source text, though without any additional commentary. Gondiac's translations, most notably his Der Thustra, may continue, and that's Thus Spoke Der Thustra by Nietzsche, may continue to provoke heated debate, but the very power of his versions implies a new theory and conception of translation, which to this day Gondiac has only hinted at. Philosopher, historian, professor, translator, friend. These pursuits are one and the same enterprise for Gondiac. Okay. Let's look at the guiding questions for Immanence of Life. One, what is a life? Two, what is the significance of the example from Charles Dickens? Why does everyone lose their sense of self to save the degenerate rogue's life? Three, whose perspective is a life? If we are entangled in strange ways, how does this interact with solipsism? If solipsism is still possible, how would it be multiple? Four, how does Deleuze's view contrast with the quote, experience in the brain model? Five, what active verbs describe how the concepts notions slash notions articulate and express behavior patterns out in the world? Avoid linking verbs when writing on ontology. What is six? What is the difference between a life and the life? This determination into suchness, particularness, thatness, mindness, and as it isness is called hyaseity. Still, how does Deleuze transform the medieval hyaseity, with its assumption of transcendence, into the dimension of immanence and actualization? How does this relate to singularities, indices, and abschattungen, i.e., adumbration in phenomenology? Seven. How does a life connect from the first instance the unity of beings due to giving primacy to the indefinite article a? This indefiniteness is an index rather than a transcendental form out there, Plato's forms, separate and away from the world. Eight. How do immanence and transcendence relate to monism and dualism? How do these relate to the nature of consciousness? How do they describe the production of conscious experience and its necessary preconditions? Or how do they at least inform them? Nine, how might a life and its accompanying model of consciousness relate to an answer to the meaning of life and why we exist in the first place, if there is such a thing? 10. How does Deleuze replace transcendence with immanence as, quote, the true reality, or does he show that they interrelate? Is one of these two fundamental metaphysical structures subordinate or superior to the other structure? Are they inseparable? Okay. So this text is just kind of dense. I encourage you to read it multiple times. I'm not going to read it multiple times, and I'll explain what I can. But he's very direct. And so if you don't know what the words mean or you haven't thought about the discourse around them, you may not, the argument may not click until you've thought about it more. What is a transcendental field? It can be distinguished from experience in that it doesn't refer to an object or belong to a subject, which is the case for empirical representation. It appears, therefore, as a pure stream of a subjective consciousness, A pre-reflexive, impersonal consciousness. A qualitative duration of consciousness without a self. It may seem curious that the transcendental be defined by such immediate givens. We will speak of a transcendental empiricism, which is like the kind of theory he's talking about here with this immanence of life, in contrast to everything that makes up the world of the subject and the object. There is something wild and powerful in this transcendental empiricism that is, of course, not the element of sensation, simple empiricism, for sensation is only a break within the flow of absolute consciousness. So this transcendental empiricism, the phenomena are in the world. They don't need a like they don't need me. The tree is still going to fall in the middle of the forest. It's still going to make a sound. It's still going to have color. It doesn't matter if there's any being there to give it those things. The world is like crazy wonderful that it has all that. There is something wild and powerful in this transcendental empiricism that is, of course, not the element of sensation, which is simple empiricism. For sensation is only a break within the flow of absolute consciousness. It is rather, however close two sensations may be, the passage from one to the other as becoming, as increase or decrease in power. So this becoming is also that relationality that I was talking about, although it's the transformation of the fundamental ongoing relationality. So the becoming reveals, a temporal becoming reveals an always already there spatial becoming. Virtual quantity. Must we then define the transcendental field by a pure immediate consciousness with neither object nor self, as a movement that neither begins nor ends? Even Spinoza's conception of this passage or quantity of power still appeals to consciousness. But the relation of the transcendental field to consciousness is only a conceptual one. Consciousness becomes a fact only when a subject is produced at the same time as its object, both being outside the field and appearing as transcendence. Again, that's transcendence with an NTS at the end, a plural of transcendent. Conversely, and where transcendent in this case is a noun, not an adjective. Conversely, as long as consciousness traverses the transcendental field at an infinite speed, everywhere diffused, nothing is able to reveal that reveal it. And he gets this from Bergson in Matter and Memory. Quote, this is Bergson, quote, as though we reflected back to surfaces the light which emanates from them, the light which, had it passed unopposed, would never have been revealed. It is expressed, in fact, only when it is reflected on a subject that refers it to objects. That is why the transcendental field cannot be defined by the consciousness that is coextensive with it, but removed from any revelation. The transcendent is not the transcendental. Were it not for consciousness, the transcendental field would be defined as a pure plane of immanence, because it eludes all transcendence of the subject and of the object. So here he is actually kind of identifying the transcendental field with a pure plane of immanence. And it does seem like the transcendental empiricism is his way of synthesizing transcendence and immanence, but in the way that the one explicates, that the one complicates the many, and the many explicate the one. Similar to that, at least, the interrelatedness between the two, the intercalation. Okay. Her back legs hurt her, and I try to like love on them and help her, but stay. Absolute immanence is in itself. It is not in something to something. It does not depend on an object or belong to a subject. In Spinoza, immanence is not immanence to substance. Rather, substance and modes are in immanence. So it's not right. We can't just like keep collapsing each dyad into the one and the many, because here, the one is supposedly supposed to go to substance as well as to immanence, but they are in relation to each other as well. All right, sweetheart. When the subject, this is Deleuze again, when the subject or the object falling outside the plane of immanence is taken as a universal subject, or as any object to which immanence is attributed, the transcendental is entirely denatured, for it then simply redoubles the empirical. And immanence, as with Kant, so he critiques Kant there, and immanence is distorted, for it then finds itself enclosed in the transcendent. Immanence is not related to something as a unity superior to all things, or to a subject as an act that brings about a synthesis of things. It is only when immanence is no longer immanence to anything other than itself that we can speak of a plane of immanence. No more than the transcendental field is defined by consciousness can the plane of immanence be defined by a subject or an object that is able to contain it. We will say of pure immanence that it is a life and nothing else. It is not immanence to life, but the immanent that is in nothing is itself a life. A life is the immanence of immanence, absolute immanence. It is complete power, complete bliss. This next sentence is kind of confusing because it is not about immanence. It's a different pronoun or a different antecedent for that pronoun. I'm going to try to say it differently. To the degree that Johann Fichte goes beyond the aporias of the subject and the object, in his last philosophy, it's actually really hard to say. But the way that it's said is, it is to the degree that he goes beyond the aporias of the subject and the object that Johann Fichte, in his last philosophy, presents the transcendental field as a life, no longer dependent on a being or submitted to an act. It is an absolute immediate consciousness whose very activity no longer refers to a being, but is ceaselessly posed in a life. The transcendental field then becomes a genuine plane of immanence that reintroduces Spinozism into the heart of the philosophical process. Did Maine de Biran not go through something similar in his quote last philosophy, the one he was too tired to bring to fruition, when he discovered beneath the transcendence of effort an absolute immanent life? The transcendental field is defined by a plane of immanence, and the plane of immanence by a life. What is immanence? A life. No one has described what a life is better than Charles Dickens. If we take the indefinite article as an index of the transcendental, a disreputable man, a rogue, held in contempt by everyone, is found as he lays dying. Suddenly, those taking care of him manifest an eagerness, respect, even love for his slightest sign of life. Everybody bustles about to save him, to the point where, in his deepest coma, this wicked man himself senses something soft and sweet penetrating him. But to the degree that he comes back to life, his saviors turn colder, and he becomes once again mean and crude. Between his life and his death, there is a moment that is only that of a life playing with death. The life of the individual gives way to an impersonal and yet singular life that releases a pure event freed from the accidents of internal and external life, That is, from the subjectivity and objectivity of what happens. A quote, Homo tantum, with whom everyone empathizes and who attains a sort of beatitude. It is a high aseity, no longer of individuation, but of singularization. A life of pure immanence, neutral, beyond good and evil, for it was only the subject that incarnated it in the midst of things that made it good or bad. The life of such individuality fades away in favor of the singular life eminent to a man who no longer has a name, though he can be mistaken for no other. A singular essence, a life. So, in both G.S. Deleuze and Jean-Luc Nancy, singularities are an immanent index of common form. And what I mean by that is traditionally we would think that, or not traditionally, Platonically, Plato would argue in the classic, in the Greek classics of the the Western philosophical tradition, Plato would argue that every cup gets its cupness from a one eternal form that exists outside of reality, and that every day desk gets its deskness from that form. And the alternative to this is a phenomenological immanent perception by which each time you experience a new desk, you kind of add on to the similarities that you've already perceived. And you may not always connect all the dots between the different desks. You may not recognize something as a desk at first. Or if you do, you may not compare it with all the differences in the other desks that you've thought of. I say this because there are likely covert adumbrations that we have not pattern recognized yet. But these adumbrations, these Abschattungen, are the you can see in the notes there that I put that the singularization is the index of the Abschattungen. And for a high aseity to be a singularization means that it's determined, not into an isolation, but into a membership within a community, I think. Mostly the indice or the indexing is what I understand, is the part of it that I understand really well. High aseity is a complicated one. Yeah, the thing that makes it its own thing. But for Deleuze, the high aseity of he will spend the next three pages or till the end of the essay talking about high aseity, and it's the way he's going to distinguish the virtuals, quote unquote, in the immanent realm from their actualization and their high aseity into this realm or into this particular thing. The interesting question is whether the high aseity is intentional. So in Sartre, we saw that you bring a sort of intention to the heil or the matter of life. And this intention helps you find the quote gun in the picture puzzle. So you're looking through a picture of trees, and he said the task is to find the hidden gun, quote unquote. And Sartre's point is that you don't need to be reflective to do this task. You can look for something non-reflectively, and your intention can be non-reflective because reflective just means that you're self-aware about it and you're not looking at yourself, looking at yourself, looking at, right? So you may not be self-aware about it. But what's interesting there is that the aseity is the determination of a thing into a particular form or an eidos an eidetic intuition, is done through consciousness in phenomenology, at least. And I think that an immanent life leaves that responsibility open to each individual as well, right? Like, in what way might you be creating the world around you, if we can think of immanence as reflections and anyway, I can't get ahead of myself. Give me one second, guys. So that's just, high aseity singularities and virtuals are some of the more complicated ideas in the second half of this short essay. We shouldn't enclose life in the single moment when individual life confronts universal death. A life is everywhere, in all the moments that a given living subject goes through and that are measured by given lived objects. An immanent life, carrying with it the events or singularities that are merely actualized in subjects and objects. This indefinite life does not itself have moments, close as they may be to one another, but only between times, between moments. It doesn't just come about or come after, but offers the immensity of an empty time, where one sees the event yet to come and already happened, in the absolute of an immediate consciousness. In his novels, Alexander Lernet Polanyi places the event in an in-between time that could engulf entire armies. The singularities and the events that constitute a life coexist with the accidents of the life that corresponds to it, but they are neither grouped nor divided in the same way. They connect with one another in a manner entirely different from how individuals connect. It even seems that a singular life might do without any individuality, without any other concomitant that individualizes it. For example, very small children all resemble one another and have hardly any individuality, but they have singularities, a smile, a gesture, a funny face, not subjective qualities. Small children, through all their sufferings and weaknesses, are infused with an immanent life that is pure power and even bliss. The indefinite aspects in a life lose all indetermination to the degree that they fill out a plane of immanence, or what amounts to the same thing, to the degree that they constitute the elements of a transcendental field. Individual life, on the other hand, remains inseparable from empirical determinations. The indefinite, as such, is the mark not of an empirical indetermination, but of a determination by immanence, or a transcendental determinability. The indefinite article is the indetermination of the person only because it is the determination of the singular. The one is not the transcendent that might contain immanence, but the immanent contained within a transcendental field. One is always the index of a multiplicity. An event, a singularity, a life. Although it is always possible to invoke a transcendent that falls outside the plane of immanence, or that attributes immanence to itself, not immanence to immanence, attributes immanence to this transcendent that falls outside of it, all transcendence is constituted solely in the flow of immanent consciousness that belongs to this plane. Transcendence is always a product of immanence. One of the clearest lines in the entire essay. Transcendence is always a product of immanence. So the guiding question is one of them subordinate? Yes, transcendence is subordinate. A life contains only virtuals. It is made up of virtualities, events, singularities. What we call virtual is not something that lacks reality, but something that is engaged in a process of actualization following the plane that gives it its particular reality. The immanent event is actualized in a state of things and of the lived that make it happen. The plane of immanence is itself actualized in an object and a subject to which it attributes itself. But, however inseparable an object and a subject may be from their actualization, the plane of immanence is itself virtual, so long as the events that populate it are virtualities. So immanence is all virtualities, and the transcendental field as a bundling. I'm not, scratch that, let's keep reading. Events or singularities give to the plane all their virtuality, just as the plane of immanence gives virtual events their full reality. So here it seems to be that the plane of immanence has full reality. The event considered as non-actualized, indefinite, is lacking in nothing. It suffices to put it in relation to its concomitants, a transcendental field, a plane of immanence, a life, singularities. A wound is incarnated or actualized in a state of things or of life, but it is itself a pure virtuality on the plane of immanence that leads us into a life. I mean, just think, this is the last era, these are the last two sentences that he published before he passed away. These are the last three sentences that he published before he passed away, where he took his own life. A wound is incarnated or actualized in a state of things or of life, but it is itself a pure virtuality on the plane of immanence that leads us into a life. I say that because this text can be dense, but he took great efforts to make it make sense. Like, he felt conviction about this. It was worth his dying breaths, his dying months. My wound existed before me. Not a transcendence of the wound as higher actuality, but its immanence as a virtuality always within a milieu, plane, or field. There is a big, I said this a minute ago, there is a big difference between the virtuals that define the immanence of the transcendental field and the possible forms that actualize them and transform them into something transcendent. I might say the various forms here. There is a big difference between the virtuals that define the immanence of the transcendental field and the various forms that may actualize them, or that do actualize them at one time or another. And at one time or another, transform them into something transcendent. It can be kind of hard to understand that, but the idea is that the iterations of smiles, my smile and your smile, is different from the immanence, the virtual smile in the plane of immanence. It's kind of like a Jungian archetype, but more metaphysical. And you don't really need to categorize the virtualities that you adumbrate. Again, like you saw me explain that the adumbrations, like the categories of smile and cry, are both adumbrations of gesture or emotion, emotine, emotiveness. And these categories can't just be all be collapsed back up to the transcendental one, the great chain of being. There are more complex interrelations between the adumbrated perceptions because phenomena and experience have been complicated. But there's this whole other kind of immanent thing behind it. Let's look at the notes before we wrap. One, again, Bergson, as though we reflected back to surfaces the light which emanates from them. The light which, had it passed unopposed, would never have been revealed. It's from Matter and Memory. Second footnote, Jean-Paul Sartre, cross-reference Jean-Paul Sartre, who posits a transcendental field without a subject that refers to a consciousness that is impersonal, absolute, immanent, with respect to it, the subject and the object are transcendence. And that's from the Transcendence of the Ego. On James, see David Lapouget's analysis, Le flux intensif de la conscience chez William James, Philosophy 46. That one, I didn't know why it was there. I don't know if I said that. I think I said that in the last episode on Sartre, and I understand why it's there now. David Lapouget is the editor of Two Regimes of Madness, and presumably either a friend or a close colleague of Deleuze when he was still alive. And so, if that's not just Lapouget's insert on their own of like, hey, this is another reference you should check, I think this idea is similar because I do the research. Then he was in discussion with Deleuze, and Deleuze would have been like, yeah, he didn't say my friend, but anyway. And that article by Lapouget was published 3 or 4 months before this was published, and about 6, 5 months before Deleuze passed away. Three, already in the second introduction to La Doctrine de la Science from Fichte, Johann Fichte, quote, the intuition of pure activity, which is nothing fixed but progressed, not a being but a life. On the concept of life according to Fichte, see Initiation à la vie bienheureuse and Marcel Giraud's commentary. The Dickens quote is from our mutual friend, page 443. And five, even Edmund Husserl admits this, quote, the being of the world is necessarily transcendent to consciousness, even within the originary evidence, and remains necessarily transcendent to it. But this doesn't change the fact that all transcendence is constituted solely in the life of consciousness, as inseparably linked to that life. This will be the starting point of Sartre's text. I, writes Deleuze, have always felt that I am an empiricist, that is, a pluralist. Guys, I think that's it. It's a tough text. It's okay if it doesn't make sense yet. It's okay if it's still confusing to me. I covered a lot of it. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I hope you all had a good semester. And if this is used in a different class, then I hope you enjoyed the semester that's coming. Because I think I might teach this for Meaning of Life in 2310 or any other. And I think I have taught it in person for World Religions 1304. So if I do that online or if I set up some kind of out of class resource, which I probably will, then I guess those students will be listening to this as well. And so whatever case it may be, wherever you're from, whatever you're doing here with me, I appreciate you being here. And I only expect the channel to keep growing. So, whether you're on YouTube or on the podcast, keep an eye out for more stuff coming. And thank you. I was just thinking about how, like, in Deleuze's photos, he always just looks so thoughtful and happy. All the animals are resting. I don't have any taxes. Animal taxes. Y'all take care. That's enough. Bye.